This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
So the Buddha said that there are different reasons, different functions of a Dharma talk, different reasons why one might want to talk about Dharma, about practice. And one of those reasons is for instructions. You know, when we open to our experience, if we have no instructions at all, it's kind of disorienting, or it can be disorienting and bewildering even sometimes. And some of the reason to hear Dharma talks is to get some instructions on how to work with the experience of being alive. And so there are instructions about meditation, there are instructions about what to do with how to behave, what to do with the body, with attention. There are all these different instructions that are hopefully helpful in bringing us to less suffering. And there's another function of Dharma talks, which is to gladden the mind. Some of the teachings in Buddhism may naturally do that. Some of the teachings in Buddhism may sound like good news. You know, like we can stop struggling, we can suffer dramatically less, right? That there's a dimension of our being that is very deeply innocent. And so we may hear some of these things, and this may gladden the mind. But even hearing about some of the more difficult teachings might gladden the mind. We may feel relieved as we hear our experience of life being described in some way, even if it's difficult. And so there can be this effect of the mind being gladdened by hearing Dharma. So these are two functions. And then the third function is around supporting the motivation to practice, of inspiring people, of encouraging people in this practice. And usually, my intention here is to give more on the instructions end, and to describe some of the tools and the processes by which the heart comes to be more free. But tonight I'm going to speak in a different way and talk about some of the outcomes of practice. And with the hope that this is supportive for you in your intention to know the Dharma, whatever that means for you. And over time, as I'm exposed to more people, as I understand my own experience with more clarity, I have come to appreciate the diversity of experience that people have, the different ways in which we grow, the different paths that we take. And sometimes it can sound a little bit like a teacher is prescribing a particular path of wisdom, of compassion, of awakening. And I think it's important to acknowledge just the range of different experience and how idiosyncratic each of our trajectories are. And all I can do is speak from my experience. It's literally all I can do. And so, these are some of the themes that have been important for me in my practice. But it's good to pay some attention to how you hear these things, how you listen to Dharma talks, how you what you think the outcomes are supposed to be of your practice. It's really good to be paying attention to the ideas that get fixed in your mind about what your practice should look like. So this is just offered as some things that may be relevant now. You may already know them as well as or better than me. But some of the kinds of fruits of practice. One of the aspects of spiritual growth is about doubt. That over time, our doubt and hesitations about the Dharma collapse. And one of the things that we may come to appreciate is that all the way along, without even maybe noticing it, there have been there's this kernel of doubt about our own capacity to wake up and about the potential of the Dharma. Sometimes this is very conscious to us. Sometimes we know the experience of doubt, of not knowing whether we should be practicing, not knowing if we're doing the right practice, not knowing if we're making enough progress, not knowing if we're good enough, not knowing if we've found just the right path. Some of these things we may be conscious of. We may be able to see the ways in which We move forward and then we retreat back into doubt. But some of this process is actually more subtle. And as doubt weakens and weakens and weakens, we see that at some level it was the default state of the mind. That there was a little piece of us that, at least a little piece, that felt like the Buddha was sort of talking about someone else. Even if we've been practicing for some time. Like, did our teachers, did they really mean me too? And emerging from this doubt is quite relieving. There's no more question about your capacity to practice in a deeply meaningful way. And there's no more doubt that these teachings are a valuable tool in creating more ease and freedom in our own life and for those that we touch. And so the melting away of this doubt leaves in its wake a kind of clarity that it's just this path, that my life is walking this path. And that might take 100, 1,000 forms of what that looks like. But there's no question what the purpose of our life is. As the philosopher Nietzsche said, he said, when there's a why, any how will do. When there's a why, any how will do. And that why is very clear. And so then life takes its shape around that why. And we find our way of walking our path. The Buddha said that he teaches just two things, suffering and the end of suffering. And in this comment that he made, he's alerting us to the fact that as human beings, we're not so good at always finding ways to be happy. And some of what the Buddha suggests is that our expectations of what will bring happiness are off somehow. That we try to take refuge in that which can't provide refuge, and we try to squeeze happiness from experiences that can't lead to happiness. And so some of the learning and the freedom that comes on this path is that we get more and more realistic in predicting what will make us happy. It's not easy or not difficult to think back on times when we had the sort of perfect end-all solution to all of our life's problems, and then perhaps had the good fortune of getting what we thought would lead to a deep ease, and it didn't totally work. I had this experience today. I bought a new computer, one of those nice silver Macintosh Max laptop. And I was even thinking about this talk as I was in the computer store. But what I realized after, I didn't even think I had it, the computer on yet. But I realized that there was a little part of me that thought the Mac was going to bring me to full enlightenment. In the sense that I just envisioned basically the cessation of all clinging. And it sounds absurd, I know. And it, what the moment that was fantasized was like, at least in that moment, I'll be done. And the tragedy is that I didn't even have the thing on yet. And that I knew it wasn't going to work out. Right, so this is a kind of maybe trivial example, but a lot of our lives are lived in that way. And kind of a psychoanalyst, Adam Phillips, said something like, he said, there is nothing quite like success to show us that we don't totally know ourselves. And so some of what we're waking up to here is what can and can't lead us into some durable sense of well-being. And as we recalibrate that, what we find is that we can really delight in what experience, what life, what things, what people can offer. And we're not so heartbroken when we don't find that acquiring something, some experience, ends all longing. And we make our choices accordingly. We become better at forecasting what will lead to well-being. And as we do this, as we open to life in this way, there's so much less anxiety as we come to really understand the roots of well-being, the roots of suffering. There's much less anxiety because we know directly that it is the momentum of the heart that most deeply affects our well-being. So as we take refuge in Dharma, as we come to seek support from the practice, from the Sangha, from the lineage of people who have practiced before us, we know that we actually don't need to worry so much about some of the conditions of our life, that we actually can open to the conditions of our life with some confidence that this too is Dharma. And so life for sure will have its ups and downs. And there's an abiding faith that all of it can soften the heart. And so we do our best to arrange conditions to be favorable. And when we've done our best, we can rest. Hoping for things to work out, but knowing that we won't be shattered if they don't happen the way we imagine. Now, in this practice of taking what I'm calling taking refuge in Dharma, and this connects back with what the gentleman asked about sitting alone versus sitting in the group. Over time, the Dharma is very alive and present with us, almost as if another being. And one of the most pervasive experiences of being human changes. And what I'm alluding to is the experience of something like loneliness or isolation. When I look in my life, I can see how something like loneliness propels a lot of activity, a lot of busyness. And this is a loneliness that we can experience alone or with people. But a sense of lack and disconnection. And over time, the Dharma feels like it's always there with us. That there's such a kind of rich web of associations with practice, with opening to life from this perspective of Dharma, that We don't feel alone. And so some of the compulsive activity that we undertake to counteract some sense of isolation or loneliness falls away because we're there, but there is practice, there is dharma, it is us. It is us. This is a quote I like from Ajahn Amaro. He's using the word, the Pali, Dhamma, not Dharma. The Dhamma is always with us. It is us. The air we breathe, the fabric of the mind, the body, the world, the universe. Everything is Dhamma. It's always here. Closer to us than we are to ourselves, much closer. And the last thing that I'll mention, which we talk about often here together, is that the Buddhist teachings are pretty radical perspective on who, what we are. And we've talked about these themes of not self, and practice in one respect makes the self more and more flexible, more and more flexible, and we're less and less fixated on who we are and who we're not. And as we start to bring into attention the identifications, the ground that we call self, the sense of I am this. I am not that. As we bring this into attention, a kind of flexibility evolves whereby we no longer feel the urgency to always be protecting self. And we see that we've lived our lives in a certain way, as if standing guard at the gates of self, welcoming some and rejecting others. And that kind of fixation leads to a staggering amount of suffering. And so we come to know this ground that we forever have thought of as our bedrock. We know that bedrock as more experience. We know it as Dharma. That the very experience of I amness is another piece of Dharma, of nature. And the self creates the perspective of being outside of nature. It's the one thing outside of nature. And practice, the practice of attention, is re-experiencing self as nature. And this frees the heart in important ways. This is Jack Kornfield. We don't know all the reasons that propel us on a spiritual journey, but somehow our life compels us to go. Something in us knows we're not here just to toil at or work. There's a mysterious pull to remember. It can be a longing from childhood or an accidental encounter with a spiritual book or figure. Sometimes it's as simple as walking in the blue-green mountains or hearing choral music so beautiful it seems inspired by the gods. Sometimes it's that mysterious transformation when we attend at the bedside of a dying person and that, quote, person vanishes from experience, from existence. A thousand gates open to the spirit, whether in the brilliance of beauty or the dark woods of confusion and sorrow, a force as sure as gravity brings us back to our heart. It happens to every one of us.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.